I just told everybody to sit down, that we might have an abrupt halt there, and sure enough, we rammed into the back of the Ocean Beauty dock.
The ferry Matanuska crashes into a Petersburg dock. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the tug captain who's rescuing crab boats in the ice-covered Bering Sea.
I said, man, you pick rough neighborhoods to play in. And he said, if it wasn't for friends like you, I wouldn't be in places like this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Jury selection got underway in Anchorage Federal Court today in preparation for the trial of Fairbanks resident and Alaska Peacemakers militia leader Francis Schaefer Cox. Cox is charged along with Coleman Barney and Lonnie Vernon of plotting to kill government employees. Cox founded the Second Amendment Task Force and claims he is a sovereign citizen. The trial is expected to last at least a month. 88 potential jurors started the day. Judge Robert Bryan listened to numerous schedule conflicts from them, ranging from a toy store employee who said his boss would need to go to a trade show in early June, to a baker with an increasingly busy spring schedule, to a mason from Kasilof, who said he only works during the spring and summer. Many jury prospects also had travel schedule conflicts, which prompted Judge Bryan to ask if the travel was for business or vacation, saying, "I care more about holidays than business trips." After potential conflicts were noted, Judge Bryan asked how many were members of gun advocacy groups such as the NRA. Amid some chuckles, nearly half raised their hands. "Can you accept firearms registration laws, whether you agree with them or not?" Judge Bryan asked. No one raised their hand to say they could not. "Can you start the trial with an open mind, without political views?" he asked. No one stirred. A bit of laughter met his next question. Do any of you have a beef with the federal government? Through it all, Francis Cox sat in the front of the courtroom with his attorney, smiling at times, but occasionally somber. Jury selection continued in the afternoon and will likely stretch into tomorrow. The state ferry Matanuska collided with a seafood processing dock in Petersburg early this afternoon. There were no reported injuries, but there was substantial damage to the Ocean Beauty seafood facility. There were also some dents in the bow of the ferry above the waterline, though she tied up safely at the terminal shortly after the incident. The Matanuska was carrying 60 passengers at the time. One of them was Petersburg resident John Bringhurst, who was surprised there wasn't more of a jolt when the 408-foot ship hit the seafood plant.
Well, we were up front and we're just kind of waiting to pull into the dock, and my wife called my attention to the fact that it looked like we were headed for the wrong dock. As I looked out the front of the ferry, I could see that we were headed right for Ocean Beauty, and there seemed to be no deterrent from that course. And as we came in a little closer, you could hear the reverse thrusters coming on, and I just told everybody to sit down, that we might have an abrupt halt there, and sure enough, we rammed into the back of the Ocean Beauty dock there. Wasn't all that big of an impact, though. We just kind of bounced off and went on our way, so it wasn't that difficult for the passengers on board.
No one was out on the Ocean Beauty dock itself when the accident occurred. The impact smashed in a significant portion of the wood and concrete dock, as well as the waterfront face of the building itself, which includes apartments upstairs. One of the company's large cranes fell most of the way through the damaged dock. Broken piling swayed in the tide. The Matanuska had been heading southbound for Petersburg's downtown ferry terminal when the accident occurred. She was heard blasting her horn multiple times before the accident. Jim Spignesi watched it from a different seafood processor's dock.
Shortly after, a couple minutes after 1 o'clock, we were watching the Matanuska come in, and it started kind of wildly turning to the port side, and I thought I was going to start going down towards the transient dock.
Instead of hitting Petersburg's North Harbor floats, he said, she hit Ocean Beauty. Department of Transportation spokesman Jeremy Woodrow said Marine Highway officials notified the Coast Guard right away. According to Woodrow, it's too early to say what caused the accident.
It'll just be speculation until we do a real complete investigation, interview all the parties that are involved, and make sure that, you know, we have all of our bases covered before we actually, you know, point a finger at what may have been the cause, whether it was a person or it was, you know, mechanical malfunction.
After examining the damage to the bow, Woodrow said the Coast Guard cleared the Matanuska to continue on her voyage at 4 p.m. Monday. She was scheduled to head south to Wrangell and then Ketchikan. The snow crab fleet is in a race against time. The Bering Sea has been covered in record-setting ice since the season got underway in January, and with just a few weeks left, fishermen still have millions of pounds of snow crab to catch. As KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, boats are going to extremes to finish in time with a little help from a tugboat stationed on St. Paul Island.
It's 11:30 on a Friday night when tugboat captain Dave Childers gets the call. The fishing vessel Stormbird is stuck in the ice about 6 miles south of St. Paul.
I got too far into this, and to go back around there would have been brutal. So we're doing about 2 knots right now, and but I can't tell what's going on in front of me.
Yeah, okay. We'll come out there and make a run line your way and see what we can do.
Childers plots a course to the distressed vessel on his navigation screen and throws the 67-foot readout into reverse. The first part of the trip is through open water, and the tug clips along briskly in the darkness. Then...
let the beatings begin.
The ice is actually pretty broken up, big 2-foot-thick pancakes with open water in between them. But it's still slow going. Every time the bow rams a big chunk, the tug lurches to a standstill, and everyone in the wheelhouse pitches forward. But Childers isn't fazed.
This here is gravy train. I think one of the worst ones we did was with the Wizard and the Alaska Spirit, went out about 15 miles southwest, and it took us 8 hours to get back in with them. That was a nightmare trip.
Childers has dozens of other stories like that from this winter, when the Bering Sea broke every ice record on the books. He's had to deal with 2-story slush waves and ice stacked 6 feet thick. Some days it would take him hours just to get from one side of St. Paul's Harbor to the other.
I've had my handed to me a few times up here this year. I've got a nice dose of humility going. Thank you.
Even on this gravy run, the ice doesn't cooperate.
Little piece of ice in the wheel there. Tried to shut one of the main engines down.
By now, the Stormbird's floodlights are clearly visible on the horizon, beaming through the otherwise pitch-black night.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, Dave. I have a lot of buddies that you've done miraculous things for, so I appreciate this.
I don't know if I'd call it miraculous or not, but yeah, we're happy to come out and help.
Yeah, well, when you're on this side of it, miraculous is a small word.
Childers may laugh, but he's fully aware of how much the crabbers are depending on him to be able to deliver their catch.
Coming out here one time to meet one of the boats, and he was in some pretty ugly stuff. You know, it was pretty bad, and we got out here to him, and he said it was nice to see us. I told him, I said, man, you pick rough neighborhoods to play in. He said, if it wasn't for friends like you, I wouldn't be in places like this.
When the boats finally meet, it's past 1 o'clock in the morning. Childers noses up to the Stormbird, throws the rudder full port, and flips around so the tug is facing back towards town. An hour and a half later, the two boats churn their way past the last ice pancakes and into open water.
I couldn't have got through there without you. Have a good evening, and thanks a million.
You bet.
The Stormbird's captain is right. He probably couldn't have made it without the readout. Having the tug in St. Paul means fishermen can make the deliveries their livelihoods depend on. But it also means pushing the limit, for better or for worse. Reporting in St. Paul, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an up-and-coming Alaska singer who took a while to find her passion.
Didn't start singing, actually, until I was probably 17 or 18. In fact, I actually hated my voice.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The APRN Speaker Series presents NPR's foreign correspondent Corey Flintoff Thursday, May 24th at the Anchorage Museum. While his career has taken him to over 45 countries, Flintoff got his start here in Alaska with the Alaska Public Radio Network as a producer and host of Alaska News Nightly. Hear from Corey Flintoff. Reservations and information for the 7 p.m. lecture and for the 6 p.m. meet and greet at alaskapublic.org. Proceeds benefit the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Changes to the J-1 visa program were announced last Friday by the State Department. While some changes take effect immediately, Alaska seafood processors, which rely heavily on the workforce it provides, won't be affected until November. It's a relief for the processors and fishermen who are preparing for salmon season. But as KMXT's Jennifer Canfield reports, it's not great news for local cannery workers in Kodiak who are struggling to make ends meet.
The program has been under scrutiny on the national stage since last fall when hundreds of J-1 student workers at a Hershey's chocolate plant in Pennsylvania walked out in protest of working conditions. Nearly 6 years ago in Kodiak, J-1 workers at the Ocean Beauty Seafood Processing Plant went on strike, saying their employer was deducting too much tax from their paychecks. But in the last decade, increasingly, J-1 workers are how seafood processors staff their operations. Towns such as Naknek, Petersburg, Cordova, and Dillingham require the influx of foreign workers as there aren't enough locals to take available jobs. The State Department and many in the U.S. Senate called for instant sweeping changes after the incident in Pennsylvania last fall. Both Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich worked quickly to stave off any rushed changes. A last-minute decision would have left many processors in Alaska understaffed and unable to process this summer's salmon harvest, something that would have negatively affected fishermen. Begich says Friday's announcement is the first step toward ensuring Alaskan hire is a priority for the industry.
This allows us some time now to focus on that. I think that's the step we wanted to see. And so it kind of has a double force. One, it keeps things moving through the summer, but now we can look at the long term and how do we ensure that people within the communities that want to work can sit down with the fishing industry and work.
However, local processing plant workers in Kodiak had been looking forward to immediate changes in the program. Processing jobs are hard to come by on the island, and many who are employed aren't getting full-time hours. In a job that pays mostly minimum wage and living in a place with the highest rents in the state, overtime is essential. Monty Haver is the executive director of the Brother Francis Shelter in Kodiak. He says the program takes work away from local families and creates poverty. He's already seen many families leave the island because they're just not getting the hours they used to.
There's a lot of stress on the families. There's a lot of stress on the social services that are trying to plug the dike, so to speak. It's much harder than it used to be. And it doesn't have to if our local canneries would use local cannery workers for their workforce.
The J-1 Exchange Visitor Visa Program was established 50 years ago and initially was used to bring academics to the United States to conduct research or to teach. The program was intended to foster cultural exchange and eventually expanded to include au pairs, educators, medical professionals, and participants in the Work and Travel USA program. Both Senators Murkowski and Begich have lauded the decision to keep the J-1 program open to processors until November, but some local workers feel that they've been passed over for cheaper labor. J-1 workers save employers money because they don't have to contribute to Medicare, Social Security, or unemployment insurance. Mary Gielis-Haver is the president of the PhilAm Association in Kodiak. She says many of her organization's members struggle because they're not getting enough work.
These people are the ones that are paying their taxes here, made their home, made their Kodiak their home, and pay taxes, send their children to school. And the problem is they're not able to make money to live and support themselves during summer. The worst thing yet is that they're not able to put money into their unemployment bank to use for the winter.
Senator Begich is proposing a new visa, tentatively called an H-2O visa, which would allow the industry to hire foreign workers without having to do so under the premise of cultural exchange. The specifics of the visa are yet to be worked out, but some of the J-1 program's biggest opponents are already optimistic. They hope that the new visa will come with stricter regulations that require processors to hire local first. Senator Begich says they haven't worked out how to ensure that, but it's a priority.
Now it's the question of how do we ensure that the processors are taking every step possible. And part of that is they know by the end of this year that the J-1 visa is going to change. So they know they have to figure this all out as the year gets closer to the end. But now there's some breathing room. I don't know what all those pieces are, but our office will be aggressive about trying to figure this out.
The J-1 program brings up to 5,000 students, many from Eastern Europe, to Alaska each summer. In Kodiak, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
A Fairbanks man who helped protect natural resources in Afghanistan is heading up a similar program for polar regions. Longtime University of Alaska Fairbanks faculty member Harry Bader recently completed 3 years in Afghanistan, serving as co-leader of a counterinsurgency cell for the U.S. Agency for International Development. Bader, who won a heroism award for his work preventing enemy exploitation of natural resources, is back at UAF, heading up a new Polar Security Center. Bader says the Defense and Homeland Security funded program is scientific research focused.
Sea ice and sea ice dynamics and unmanned aerial vehicles and over-the-horizon radars. But also it'll have a policy component as well as, I hope, a tactical component where we can partner with the Coast Guard and the military and our state and local emergency management services and industry partners to try to find ways to protect the Arctic.
Bader says the threat to the polar regions has escalated in recent years as climate change has opened up access and demand for the region's natural resources has increased. He says the Arctic can fall prey to a range of rogue activities.
A terrorist threat to energy infrastructure in the Arctic domain. There could be rogue fisheries activities, criminal cartels in the Pan-Arctic, especially as it relates to Russian Far East natural resource exploitation.
Bader says the UAF Polar Region Security Center is focused on the protection of economic and other values Alaskans are familiar with.
As the Arctic is very much an energy sink and a carbon sink, which is a very important role, as well as social services. And we have, as you know, Native communities that are dependent, as well as the Western communities that the role that not just economic and ecological, but in terms of recreation, that these are all areas that are important to maintain.
Bader says the Polar Security Center will also have an instructional role. He says the center is tying in with an emergency management and security degree program offered through the School of Management.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Alaska's Supreme Court will hear arguments Thursday on which voting district map will be used for this year's elections. The State Redistricting Board had filed a petition with the High Court asking that its April 5th proclamation plan be used after a lower court judge rejected the board's second attempt at a redistricting plan. The Supreme Court has issued a May 8th deadline for responses to both the board's request for review of the lower court decision and its petition to use its first redistricting plan in this year's election. A state redistricting plan must be in place by May 14th. Researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks are studying invasive plants in Alaska and how they could be affecting native tundra berries. The invasive plants can be found across interior Alaska, and while they likely have not yet spread off the road system to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, some believe it's only a matter of time. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Mark Earhart has more.
Since we don't buy fruit from the stores in the villages, we get different kind of berries, and different berries grow at different times, not all at once.
Elsie Jimmy of Quigilinguk and Bethel has been picking berries since she was 5 or 6. She says she loves to pick the various kinds of fruit that grows across the tundra. There's jam to make and a gudeg to share.
Probably the first one we pick is the blueberry because it gets ripe first.
Jimmy says she and her family fill freezers full of berries each summer, and she's not alone, as berry picking is a time-honored tradition here in the YK Delta. But there is a non-native plant growing in the interior of Alaska that could someday threaten the wild blueberries and cranberries that dot the tundra.
The scientific name is Melilotus alba.
That's Krista Mulder, an associate professor of ecology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She says the plant, also known as sweet clover, affects the pollination of tundra berries and other native plants.
It looks a little bit like a regular clover with a three-leaf clover, but it's got much longer flower stalks and smaller leaves.
Mulder says that there could be a slightly positive effect on fruit growth if the berry plants flower before the sweet clover plants. But she says when the sweet clover flowers around the same time and in the same area as the tundra berries, say within 5 or 20 meters, it attracts more pollinators like bees and other insects.
It's likely to be much more of a problem in the places where it overlaps a lot in flowering times with the blueberries and the cranberries.
These extra visitors could potentially have a negative effect on the amount of fruit berry plants can produce by bringing the wrong kind of pollen, Mulder says.
But it hasn't gone out to most of the places that are off the road system. But there's very good reason to believe it'll get there sooner or later. It's really easy to transport. You know, you can walk around in a field, get some on your shoes, step on a plane, get back off the plane, and there you've got it.
She says the plants could already be in the area. It's just that nobody has noticed them.
But it's almost guaranteed to get there at some point.
If the sweet clover ever arrives and affects plants in the ways researchers think it could, one of the first to notice could be Elsie Jimmy, and the results could be seen in her freezer. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
You don't hear the glockenspiel much in modern music, but Alaska singer-songwriter Meg Mackey weaves it, along with acoustic and electric guitar, accordion, banjo, and foot stomps, onto her new album, Eat Your Heart Out. KSKA's Daisha Eaton talked with the singer and has the story.
Anchorage-based singer-songwriter Meg Mackey has been making her way around the city's music venues to showcase her debut album, Eat Your Heart Out.
It's completely and utterly straight from my heart.
Born on the island of Guam, 27-year-old Mackey grew up a self-described military brat, spending her early years in San Antonio, Texas, attending African-American and Hispanic church services. And you can hear that influence in songs like Rendered Useless, a collaboration with the Spinard Street Choir. In 1991, 7-year-old Mackey moved with her family to Palmer, where she did homeschool and got into dog mushing. She credits yelling at the dogs with helping build her strong alto vocal cords. And no, as far as she knows, she's not related to Lance Mackey. When she was 14, she picked up a guitar that was laying around the house, but it took her a while to get comfortable with her own voice.
Didn't start singing, actually, until I was probably 17 or 18. In fact, I actually hated my voice. I was one of those kids who, if I had left a message on an answering machine, I'd be like, "Turn that crap off!" You know, I don't want to hear myself. You know, and it definitely took me a minute to accept. You know what I mean? To kind of accept my own voice.
She began writing music and playing around campfires in her early 20s while she was working in tourism in the Juneau ice fields and at a lodge in Wrangell St. Elias National Park, putting together the songs for what would become her first full-length album. When she was 21, she settled in Juneau. But she says there's only so many places you can play in a city that size, and Anchorage kept calling her name.
And I had a lot of friends just telling me what was going on here in Anchorage, you know, just kind of saying the music scene was kind of building its way up the West Coast.
So a year ago, she quit her barista job and moved to Anchorage's Spinard neighborhood, arguably the epicenter of the city's growing indie music scene. Now she's playing music full-time. She says she was met with open arms, and she hasn't looked back.
I mean, it's an amazing place. The venues here treat you so well. I mean, the people here have been just so supportive. Musicians, producers, the people that own, you know, the recording studio, Ken Cease's recording studio over at Twisted Penguin.
That Spinard studio is where two well-known Anchorage musicians, Evan Phillips, the frontman for the Whipsaws, and James Domick Jr., a drummer for the same band, produced Mackie's album. Domick Jr., Martin Severin, who's also in the Jack River Kings, and James Glaives, who also plays with Ghost Hands, make up the Meg Mackie Band. Mackie's imaginative, intimate songwriting and raw vocals reach out and grab your heart. And listening, you feel as if you've been invited to hang out with her around a campfire to waste some time.
Why don't you waste your time with me? We could be happy, we could be in southern Georgia, eat a peach. I'll blow you kisses by the sea.
Meg Mackie is set to take her uniquely Alaskan sound to Philadelphia to play at the World Cafe Live on Wednesday, May 9th. Oh, and the song with the glockenspiel? It's called Tiny Toes, and she says all her friends' kids love it.
Little tiny toe, running on the shore. Castles raining high, the biggest one is mine.
In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
You can listen to some Meg Mackie music and find out where she's playing this summer at alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Stephanie Joyce in St. Paul, Jennifer Canfield in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Send me something really cool in the morning, and I'll be happy that I got to be going, cause I'll be seeing you first thing in the morning.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
The grocery store meltdown. We've all seen it. Harried and frustrated mom, tired toddler in full tantrum mode, and out of nowhere comes a young stock clerk. Drops to his knees next to the screaming child and starts rolling cans and making funny noises. The diversion works. Distracted from his tantrum, the toddler stops crying. Mom takes control and finishes her shopping. Families are stronger when others take an interest. This message sponsored by Best Beginnings, Alaska's Children's Trust, and Strengthening Families Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.